I got here this morning and we started going over the homework and answering questions within the small group leaders about what the Lord had showed us this week and all of those things, many things started coming to my mind, and it's a little scary when these things happen about, oh, I need to share this, but it's not in my notes. And so part of me just wants to put my notes on the ground and just share what the Lord has put on my heart these last couple weeks as I've been preparing for this message. And then the other part of me is absolutely terrified to not have notes in front of me. So if I'm all over the map, I apologize, but these verses that we have in front of us are so incredibly applicable to us as women and to us personally today, even though they happened centuries ago. There's just so much to say, and I have 45 minutes. Today's passage, we are going to explore the faith of three different groups and one individual. Our passage, it picks up right where we left off when we were last together. When we were doing our homework this last week, we were asked to go back in Mark and write down and look at all the things that Jesus had done up to this point and the response of the people to the things that he had done. It was such a great exercise to see what the people, especially the disciples, had witnessed up until this point. What is it that they already know about Jesus? What is it that because they know, they should be able to recall and remember when they are in the storms? I thought this was so incredibly important for us to do. Jesus will do two more miracles in our passage this morning. And the response of those who witness these miracles reveals their faith. This begs us to evaluate our own faith in light of all that we know and all that we understand. Even if we want to take the few short chapters that we've already been through, that should be enough. That should be enough. In times of trouble and great distress, where is your faith? This is the question before us all this morning. It begs us to evaluate our own faith in light of what the Bible has taught us. So look at verse 35. On that same day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." On that same day. And what a long day it had been for Jesus and the disciples. Remember, Jesus had taught the parable of the sower or the soils. And let us not forget who was there for the parable and the explanation of the parable. The disciples, they were there. They heard all of it. They saw Jesus' heart in it. And then they were given a private explanation of what it meant. Verse 35, on that same day when evening had come, Jesus said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." Now when they had left the multitude, they took him, Jesus, along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. It was evening. The day had come to a close, and Jesus said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." Matthew and Luke's Gospels both share this account in chapter 8 of their Gospels. They both tell us it was the disciples who got in the boat with them. Mark's Gospel leaves that detail out, that it was the disciples who got in the boat with them. But we know from the other Gospels that the disciples got in the boat with Jesus. And they took him along as he was. And this simply means that he didn't go home and change his clothes. He didn't take a break. He didn't get out of the boat and go have dinner. He'd been teaching from the boat, and they likely took off from shore with Jesus in the same boat. Now, can we assume that Jesus was unbelievably exhausted? He had been healing. He had been accused of having a demon. He was teaching his guts out in the form of parables and then explaining those parables. It's now evening, and in his humanity, he had to have been utterly spent. In verse 37, it says, "And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling." A great windstorm arose. Matthew's gospel says, "Then suddenly," key word there, suddenly, "a great tempest arose." The language in both Mark and Matthew's gospel makes it very clear that the sea was calm when they got in the boat and they left the shore. A great windstorm, a great tempest, Luke's gospel says, a great windstorm came down. Now, the word tempest that we read of in Matthew's gospel is the Greek word seismos, and it refers to a commotion, a shaking, an earthquake. Yikes. Verse 37 tells us that the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. Many of the disciples were seasoned fishermen, and therefore they were sailors. They knew the sea. They understood the weather patterns. I doubt this was the first storm they had experienced on the Sea of Galilee. We are about to read their response to the storm, which reveals the severity of what was happening. Think of what this must have been like for them. It is likely dark. They are probably tired too. The sea is familiar territory for them, but a storm like no other comes upon them suddenly without warning. It is violent. They are shaking. It is like an earthquake. The sea is shaking. Therefore, their boat is shaking. And the boat is beginning to fill with water. And we know that a boat that is filling with water is a sinking boat. As they're being tossed around, shaking violently because of the motion of the boat, they cannot bail the water out of the boat. It must have been terrifying. But, verse 38, he, Jesus, was in the stern asleep on a pillow. Jesus was asleep in the back of the boat on a pillow. I find the pillow so interesting. Why is it mentioned? I wanted to figure this out. Why is it mentioned? And I'm sure Jesus had a My Pillow. He would want to support his fellow Christian businessman. But Jesus was so weary. He was so tired. He was so desperate for sleep. And I believe there was a cushion in the back of the boat, and that is where he went. He went and he found a pillow, so that he could rest and be replenished. He got in the boat and he said, "Let us cross to the other side." He knew where they were going. He knew that they would get there. And therefore, he slept. He was at peace and he could sleep. The storm did not wake Jesus up. The disciples did. And they awoke him and they said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" These tough guys, these fishermen, I don't know if you've watched The Chosen, but Peter, you know, he's always wearing a muscle tee. And I think it's just to show off the biceps of the actor who plays him. But these tough guys, they turn into a bunch of little girls. "We're going to die! You don't care about us, we're going to die." They woke Jesus up. He's asleep in the back of the boat. They wake him up. They refer to him as teacher, but they didn't say help. And even though in Matthew's gospel it did say save us, here we don't see them saying help, stop the winds, or wake up, because we don't want you to get swept away either. But it's as if they were waking him up for him to join them in their fear. "Do you not care that we are dying?" They included Jesus in their impending death. They actually said to Jesus, "Do you not care?" You can go back to the first page of your homework and reread the things you wrote down that these men had already witnessed Jesus do. What happened? They forgot. They forgot. Do you not care? He'd been doing nothing but caring since the onset of his ministry. Their rebuke of the Lord was unfounded in light of the care he had been demonstrating from the beginning of his ministry. Even in this massive storm, they should not have feared their lives. Why? Because Jesus had said they would go to the other side. Why? Because he was right there with them. Why? Because they could actually visibly look at Jesus, see that he was asleep, see that he was not disturbed by the storm, that he was peaceful. This last summer, my 8-year-old grandson, Sawyer, developed an intense fear of tornadoes. And it didn't help that Dave and I showed him The Wizard of Oz. But so afraid of tornadoes, and this led to a storm of any kind would create anxiety in him. And even if rain was coming or if he saw something coming off of a cloud, he would get fearful that there was going to be a tornado. And if anything changed in the sky with the clouds, he'd frequently run to the window and look and see if there was change. He would go on my phone, he'd look at the weather app, and then he'd tell me the percentage of chance of rain coming in 2 hours. And it was so sad to watch. It was hard for his parents. It was hard for Dave and I. We didn't want him to have this anxiety. And we would pray with him, and we would give him some tools of what to do when he was feeling afraid that a tornado was going to come. And I told him that when he was afraid, that there was a list of things that he needed to do in order. And first, he needed to pray and ask God to protect him. If he thinks a tornado may come, then it makes sense for him to pray and say, Lord, protect me from a tornado, even though there's not even a possibility of a tornado. But simply to calm his fear, stop what you're doing, pray, ask God to protect you. And the next thing he needed to do was he needed to look around at those who were with him, those that he loved and trusted, and see if they seemed concerned. This is a tactic that I use when I was afraid of flying. I used to have a terrible fear of flying. And if something uncertain happened on the plane, if the engine started sounding funny, or we were moving in a way I wasn't familiar with, the first thing I would do, it should have been pray, sometimes it was, but I would look around and I would look on the faces of the passengers and I would look and I would try to find the flight crew. You know, are they on the phone with the pilot? You know, are they starting to get, you know, rescue equipment out of the overhead bins? No. Everybody's just pouring their coffee and everybody's reading their books and it's like, okay, my fear is unfounded. And then finally I told Sawyer that he needed to trust those who loved him to take care of him should there be a storm. That we would listen to the alarm on our phone and we would go down in the basement. We would close the windows. We would do all that we could to protect him. He needed to learn to trust. The disciples could have just looked at Jesus and been assured that they were okay. He was asleep on a pillow. Not only was Jesus not afraid, he was asleep. And this did not seem to be the type of storm one would sleep through. Jesus had just taught of the seed that falls on stony ground. Remember, go over to chapter 4, just right over to chapter 4, verse 16. These likewise are the ones sown on stony ground, who when they hear the word, immediately receive it with gladness, and they have no root in themselves. And so endure only for a time. Afterward, when tribulation or persecution arises for the word's sake, immediately they stumble. They heard the word, they're so excited, they want to serve Jesus, they drop everything they have and they go and they follow him. But then the storm came, the tribulation, and immediately they forgot everything that they knew, and they stumbled. And they said that the Lord did not care. Verse 39, then Jesus arose and he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased and there was a great calm. Jesus arose, this means that he woke up. And he said to the wind, Jesus spoke to the wind. He spoke to the wind. Peace, be still. In Mark 1:25 that we looked at a couple weeks ago, Jesus rebuked the demon in similar language and he said, be quiet and come out. The Prince of Peace brought peace to the demonized man and he brought peace to the Sea of Galilee. But more importantly, he brought peace to the trembling hearts of the disciples. There was a great calm. Jesus spoke to the wind and the wind obeyed. Jesus, what a testimony this must have been to the disciples. I think we forgot who was asleep here on his pillow. There was a great calm. The language in this verse indicates the calm was immediate. Can you imagine the boisterous noise of the roaring storm instantly ceasing and there was nothing but quiet? And in that quiet, Jesus said to the disciples, why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith? In Luke's gospel, Luke records Jesus saying, where is your faith? Matthew records Jesus saying, why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Imagine how the disciples must have felt as they were filled with wonder at the calm. And then immediately, Jesus reproves them. Oh. Jesus saw no faith, none, zilch. And this is why he asked them a question rather than make a statement. He asked them this question because Jesus knew that they should have faith based on what they already knew. He asked a question. He didn't say, hey, you guys need to have more faith. Let's have a little study on that as we calmly get to the other side of the Galilee, like I said we would. He didn't say, I will never leave you or forsake you. He didn't say, let me tell you who I am and why you don't need to be afraid. No, he asked them why they were afraid and where was their faith? Why did they have no faith in that moment? He'd already shown them who he was. He had just told them they were going over to the other side. He was at peace during the storm. They had seen his great works. They had seen his miracles. They knew of his power. So why, how could they say, do you not care? We're going to die. Do you know Jesus, girls? Do you know his promises? Are you growing roots in good soil? Do you remember the goodness of the Lord? But then a storm comes, a trial comes, and these roots start to pull up. And you stumble and you cry out in the storm, why? Where are you, Jesus? Are you asleep? Do you not care? Do we not do the same thing as the disciples? In verse 31, and they, the disciples, they feared exceedingly and said to one another, who can this be that even and the wind and the sea obey them? Jesus rebukes their fear, and still they feared exceedingly at his power and questioned who he was after all they had already seen. The word fearful that we see in verse 40, why are you so fearful? It is the Greek word delos. It means timid, faithless, cowardly. Little girls. We're going to die! The word feared in verse 41 is the Greek word phobio. It means literally to fear, a great fear, fear exceeding, but it is also the Greek word which means to reverence or to be struck with amazement and awe. They started out cowardly, but when they saw the power of Jesus, that he could speak, speak to the wind and the wind would obey him. They revered him. Now in verse 1 of chapter 5, then they came to the other side of the sea. They have now come to the other side of the sea, just as Jesus had said they would. Think about that. They came to the country of the Gadarenes. We can find this account in Matthew and Luke's gospel as well. Also in chapter 8 of both of those gospels, also immediately following the calming of the storm. Matthew cites two demonized men in this scene. But for the sake of our text today, we will focus on the one demonized man as Mark did. It goes on in verse 2 and it says, and when he had come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one could bind him, not even with chains, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been pulled apart by him and the shackles broken in pieces. Neither could anyone tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stones. This man, who had an unclean spirit, he had an absolutely wretched life. Whatever choices he had made, which at some point in his life caused him to allow the influence of a demon to come into his life, resulted in the saddest and most destitute life. He didn't live in a house with walls and safety. He lived in the tombs. People tried to restrain him with chains and shackles, but he could not be tamed. We know from Matthew's gospel that no one could come near him. From Luke's gospel, we know that he wore no clothes. He harmed himself. He cried out day and night. The demons physically tormented the man from within and without. This man's life was absolutely sad and horrible. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshiped him. And he cried out with a loud voice and said, what have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God that you do not torment me. The demons knew the true identity of Jesus. They had a kind of faith. James 2:19 says, you believe there is one God? As James is speaking about faith without works is dead. And simply saying that you believe really shows that you have no faith at all if there was no evidence of your faith. You believe there is one God? You do well. Good for you, he's saying. You mean the demons believe and they tremble. The disciples were accused of having no faith. Or at least that their faith seemed to have been misplaced. The demons showed faith in the basic understanding of who Jesus was, and they showed understanding of their rank under Jesus. Their understanding of the authority that Jesus had in their life over them. They honored his authority, and they could do nothing but worship Jesus. In verse 8, for he said to him, come out of the man, unclean spirit. Then he asked him, what is your name? What the demon said in verse 7, or the demons as we find out later, said in verse 7, what have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God that you do not torment me. This was out of response to Jesus already commanding the demons to come out of the man. And before they did so, Jesus asked, what is your name? What is your name? And he answered, saying, my name is Legion, for we are many. A Roman legion, the word legion, spoke of a Roman legion that consisted of 6,000 foot soldiers, as well as 120 horsemen. There were many. It's horrible to think of this poor man, regardless of his choices. There were many. Also, he begged him earnestly that Jesus would not send them out of the country. Now, a large herd of swine was feeding there near the mountains. So all the demons begged him, saying, "Send us to the swine that we may enter them." And at once Jesus gave them permission because he is the authority over all principalities. Then the unclean spirits went out, entered the swine. There were about 2,000 swine. And the herd ran violently down the steep place into the sea and drowned in the sea. It's interesting that the demons had to ask Jesus permission. And not only that, but they were pleading with him to not send them out of the country showed that they did not know the future. They did not know where they were going to go. They did not know what Jesus was going to do. Satan does not know our thoughts. He does not know the future. By sending the demons into the swine, it was proof to all who were there that a miracle of deliverance had actually taken place. The destruction of the pigs showed that the spirits were actually gone. So those who fed the swine fled, and they told it in the city and in the country, and they went out to see what it was that happened. Then they came to Jesus, and they saw the one who had been demon-possessed and had the legion sitting and clothed in his right mind, and they were afraid. So the pig farmers, they left immediately. We need to leave immediately. We need to go tell everybody what happened so nobody thinks that we destroyed these 2,000 pigs and our master's livelihood. They told everyone, and the people came. What did they see? They saw a colossal display of Jesus' power. This tortured man was clothed and sitting in his right mind. His life, just moments before, was like the storm the disciples had just been in. They'd just gotten out of the boat. They just saw Jesus calm this monumental storm. And now, just like he spoke to the wind, he spoke to the demons. And this man experienced calm and peace. What is it with the faith of the people? The people who came to witness this great miracle. No more pigs, and this man that I'm sure everyone knew about, sitting dressed and in his right mind. Why weren't they bowing down and asking all about Jesus? They were afraid. This word afraid, it's also the Greek word phobio, which was the same word used to describe the disciples after Jesus calmed the storm. But in this context, it means to be struck with amazement. They were struck with amazement at what Jesus had done. They were amazed at the miracle. But in verse 16, it says, "And those who saw it told them how it happened to him who had been demon-possessed and about the swine. Then they began to plead with him, Jesus, to depart from their region." So they're struck with amazement and awe. And their response to that was to say, "Get out of here. We want nothing to do with you." Where's their faith? It is evident that they had none, and tragically, they wanted none. Rather than seek to learn more about Jesus, he was right there. They could have done that. They could have asked. They could have talked to the man sitting there in his right mind. They could have talked to the disciples. They wanted nothing to do with him. Perhaps they were afraid of what he did to the livelihood of the swine owner, showing that their main interest was not for more miracles, but what Jesus could potentially do to their economy. Rather than put their faith in the miracle that he did, they were afraid of the power that he exemplified, and they wanted him to go. What a tragedy. They asked him to go, and what did Jesus do? Got in the boat. And when he got into the boat, he who had been demon-possessed begged him that he might be with Jesus. Look at this man's faith. He was healed. He was set free. He was restored. His raging storm had ceased. And now he wants to remain with Jesus. He begs Jesus to let him go with him. Please let me go with you, Jesus. And what does Jesus say? Jesus did not permit him, but he said to him, go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you. Jesus told him to go and tell. And I believe that as he were to go and tell, that in his telling, not only would that bring other people to faith, it would increase his faith. And the more he told, the more he would be able to remember, so that the next time he faced a storm, he could draw upon what he had now hidden in his heart. He could draw upon the faith that came from going and telling. And verse 20 says that he did just that. He departed and he began to proclaim in Decapolis all that Jesus had done for him. And all marveled. Jesus asked the man to tell others, to be a witness. His testimony was so great. What Jesus did for him was miraculous, and others must know so that they can know who Jesus is. We see the faith of many in our passage. The missing faith of the disciples, the non-saving faith of the demons, the refusing of faith by the townspeople, and the newfound simple faith of the man healed from the legion of demons. Faith must always be tested. It tells us in James chapter 1, my brethren, count it all joy. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Count it joy when you face incredible storms, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. There's work being done. Storms are part of the process. They are what allow us to walk worthy. The crossing of the Sea of Galilee was a test of the disciples' faith. They had been witnesses of the power of Jesus. He told them where they were going. He was peace. They had faith, but they misplaced it. They were afraid. They accused Jesus of not caring. It's astounding. It really is. He's right there in the boat. He told them where they were going. They can see that he is at peace. But is it really astounding? Are we not just the same? Do you ever feel like Jesus isn't there? Where are you, Lord? Or maybe you feel like he's asleep on his my pillow and he just doesn't care. Maybe it seems like maybe he's forgotten. I'm sure that's how the disciples felt on that night. You've got all of this turmoil, this storm is raging within you and around you and outside of you. He's just over there on his pillow. But when we are in that place of waiting and we're waiting on the Lord, it oftentimes seems that he is silent. That is purposeful. He wants us to draw upon what we already know of him. He wants us to remember. He does not want us to forget. See, the greatest danger for the disciples was not the storm, it was unbelief. The same is true for us. Our trials and our troubles are not the greatest danger. Our unbelief is. Our getting all wrapped up in the storm and thinking that Jesus is not with us is the greatest danger. It tells us in Hebrews 3:12, beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. Unbelief separates us from God. We today must believe the promise of where we are going. We must believe the promise that he will never leave us or forsake us. God does not keep us from the storms. He is with us in the storm. Just as Jesus was with the disciples, God knows every wave that falls on us. He knows the number of hairs on our head. He knows all of our thoughts. He holds our tears in a bottle. He rejoices over us with singing and gladness. He is right here with us in our boat. Jeremy Taylor said, "We are far safer in the middle of a storm with God than anywhere else without Him. Amen. And He has the power. He has the power to calm the winds and the sea. He has the power to restore the most destitute of men. And if anyone is here today and thinks they are beyond God's restoration, look to the restoration of this man. No one here in this room is as destitute as this man was. And Jesus, in a word, restored him to peace. What is your storm? Is it a tumultuous marriage? Has someone harmed you recently or many, many years ago? Is your storm cancer or chronic illness? Is it singleness or infertility, divorce, hurtful relationships, estrangement from a parent or a child? Have you lost someone dear? Are your finances a mess? Do you feel all alone? What is your storm? I don't just want this to be another teaching. It's all going to be hunky-dory. Just keep your eyes on the Lord. You know, be warm and be filled. No. Storms are hard, and it's very difficult for us to grasp the future hope that we have because it's the unseen, it's the unknown, and it requires faith. What is faith? What is faith? And in our storm, sometimes we want, I have no faith. I don't have any faith. It's too much. What is faith? And I'm reading from the New Living Translation, and this is the definition of faith according to the Bible in Hebrews 11:1. Faith is the confidence that what we hope for will actually happen. It gives us assurance about the things that we cannot see. Faith is the hope that Jesus said we will get to the other side. Faith is the hope that Jesus said I will never leave you or forsake you. Faith is the hope that I've gone to prepare a place for you and I will come back again for you. It is the hope, but it's unknown and it's unseen and it's difficult and it's hard. But we have to remember what He has done. We have to remember what He has told us in His word. We have to, and this is how we get faith, we have to abide in Him. As it tells us in John chapter 15, the God is the vine. The God is the vine dresser, and Jesus is the vine, and we are the branches, and we must abide in Him. We must stay. We must remain. We must spend time in His word. And when we abide and we stay and we dwell and we remain, we will bear fruit and we will grow those roots so that when we are in a storm, those roots won't get uprooted and we go, we're going to die. Where are you, Lord? Do you not care? But this is what is so important. We have to hide His word in our heart. We have to hide His promises in our heart. We have to remain and abide in God's word all the time and every day so when the storms come, we can draw upon it. And if we don't abide and the storms come, we have nothing to draw upon. We have to remember. We have to know. Last spring, as we were just coming into the end of winter and it was still getting cold as the sun would set, I had gone to King Soopers, I'd gotten some groceries, I loaded them in my car, and then I locked my keys and my phone and my three-year-old grandson in the car. And the sun was setting, and I didn't have a jacket, and it was 30 degrees, and I realized, I can't leave, I can't go back in the store, I can't leave my grandson in the car. I had to stop a stranger in the parking lot and ask to use their phone. And the only phone number I know by heart is my husband's. It would have done me a lot of good to have known before the storm hit some other phone numbers. And of course, my husband has a setting on his phone that if an unknown phone call comes through, it goes straight to voicemail. So his phone never rang, so I left him a text message from this stranger's phone. I'm not going to tell you the whole story. But I'm standing here before you today, not in prison for locking my grandson in my car. But for 20 minutes in the freezing cold without a jacket, I had wished I had hidden some phone numbers in my mind. Fortunately, my son was coming to pick up my grandson, and he was there at the house, and it was him who said to my husband, knowing I was at the grocery store, "Dad, where's Mom? I'm supposed to be back here with Ezra." And so they went and got his phone and saw the message and came and got him. But it's like that in our storms. We have to know God's word now. We have to hide it in our heart now. So when circumstances come and the boat is filling up with water and it's shaking violently like an earthquake and we are unable to bail out the water, we can cry upon the Lord and say, "Lord, I know that you care. I know that you care. I know that you've promised that we will get to the other side. I know you promised that you would never leave me or forsake me. I know I have an eternity with you." And again, that's difficult to grasp. All we know is a 24-hour day and 80 years of life, and every single day without a loved one or with a disease or hurtful people in our life. Loss, destruction, it's hard to grasp. So we must abide. Jesus is here. He's right with us in the storm. But we must be rooted in his word. The seed must take root on good soil, not the stony ground, so that we can have the faith, the confidence of the hope, assurance of our future to carry us through until we get to the other side. We don't know when that other side is. We don't know when we're going to get to the other side. We don't know if in the storm that we are in right now, if Jesus is going to calm it in our lifetime. But he will calm it. With a word, all the commotion will cease, and there will be great peace. Do we believe this? Where is your faith?